From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment. George Orwell famously wrote in his classic novel of oppression, 1984. Now, here we are. It's 2013. And the headlines are all about surveillance without obvious limits. The NSA, Edward Snowden, you, all of us as data surveilled. This hour on Point, we're talking with big digital thinker Jaron Lanier about privacy and liberty in the age of the Internet. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you rethinking your personal boundaries this week? Do we have any? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a moment, we'll go to Jaron Lanier, author of the new book, Who Owns the Future? But first, the latest on the NSA, Edward Snowden, and surveillance. I'm joined from Washington by Craig Timberg, national technology reporter for The Washington Post. Craig Timberg, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be with you.
So we have more testimony going on today behind closed doors, as we were just hearing from the head of the NSA, General Keith Alexander. Lots to ask you about here, Craig, but let's start with the general. He's in charge of both the NSA and the United States Cyber Command. What did you learn? What did you take away from his open testimony yesterday?
Well, it was fascinating. He went up there defending the program, saying that dozens of attacks have been prevented by the use of this technology, which is a pretty forceful way to respond. And it's, from my point of view, one of the fascinating things to watch has just been this divergence of what the government's been saying and what the technology companies have been saying. Clearly, this was everybody's secret at one point, and now they're responding to this controversy in completely different ways.
Here's a little bit of General Alexander saying he'd rather take a beating than jeopardize the country.
I would rather take a public beating and people think I'm hiding something than to jeopardize the security of this country.
And his claim of dozens of events prevented.
It's dozens of terrorist events that these have helped prevent.
Craig Timberg, is that a credible claim?
Yeah, there's no way to know. We obviously don't have privy. We're not privy to this kinds of secrets that General Alexander is. But the response you tend to get from civil liberties groups is, well, okay, you've prevented some attacks, but that doesn't mean that you get necessarily infinite access to all our information anytime for any reason. And so there's a strong desire among lots of civil libertarians and probably Americans in general to map out, where the rules are and to draw some lines in terms of what kind of access is appropriate and why.
What were you hearing from senators questioning him? Did they seem supportive of the security task and role here or more skeptical about that given the concerns about privacy and civil liberties?
It's been interesting watching the Hill over the past few days. I mean, they're in an awkward position because a lot, I presume most of them knew about this in one way, shape, or form, and they didn't speak up before now. So it isn't like many of them are about to go on the attack, but there is a very deep and widespread concern about privacy among lawmakers on the Hill, and they're wrestling with it the same way the rest of us are.
Let me ask you about another side of this, and that is, some of the big companies in Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, and more, who the leaks told us, Edward Snowden said, had given direct access to a lot of their computer systems to the NSA. Now, they've been protesting and saying no, and they've been saying, please let us be more transparent about what we're doing so that people won't think that we're just a wide open book for the NSA. I want to play a little tape and get your response, Craig. This is Google's Senior Vice President and Corporate Development and Chief Legal Officer David Drummond denying, this is on PBS NewsHour Tuesday, open government access to Google's computers.
Let me be very clear about this. We do not participate in any kind of a program that gives the government any access to our servers, direct or otherwise, nor do we allow the government to place any kind of equipment on our systems.
So what is going on here, Craig? Do we understand what's happened? Do we have any idea? There's this flat denial of what was a pretty central representation in the leaks.
The technology companies to sort of have been put in really in a horrendous position, right? Clearly, clearly they were forced to give some kind of access to the NSA, to all sorts of information that they would have rather kept private. Whatever that communication was between the tech companies and the NSA was supposed to be kept secret, right? And the technology companies are you know, particularly Google and Facebook, they rely on their ability to make users feel comfortable with them and to make users give up all sorts of personal private information. And so, you know, they are horrendously exposed now. They clearly are sharing something under some circumstances, and they're trying to tamp it down while General Alexander's on the Hill defending it, while President Obama is out in public defending this exact program. So it's, I agree with you that it has been confusing to figure out exactly where the lines are, but they are in a world of hurt from a public relations point of view.
Are we ever going to really know what's going on? I mean, there are very large claims made here that affect both citizens and these companies and our understanding of what our government's doing. Are we going to know?
It's a great question. I have to say that I was surprised that we've learned as much as we have. I mean, I sort of always figured that there was a certain amount of access that the NSA and other government authorities get to all sorts of online information. But we've learned a lot more than I expected we would learn. And so whether we learn more or not, it's hard to know.
Finally, let's go to Edward Snowden. He is still, as far as we know, in Hong Kong, talking with my alma mater there, first newspaper I worked at as a reporter, the South China Morning Post, saying that he's got more to say. Is there any sense at this point of what that might be, where it might take us?
Yeah, there may be journalists here that know, but I'm not one of them. He has been an unpredictable character in this drama, and so if he says he has more, I guarantee you that we'll be listening and wanting to know what he has to say. Which is not to say that, you know, the Post or any reputable news organization is just going to sort of dump this stuff into the public domain. But I'll tell you, it's a lot harder than it was when I started in this business 20 years ago to control information that somebody wants to get out. If he has something to say, you'll be hearing it awfully soon, whether it's to the Washington Post or the South China Morning Post.
Is there any further word on the potential prosecution of Mr. Snowden?
Well, you have to assume that they're working awfully hard to get at him and prosecute him. But no, I don't have any details on how that's going.
This thing just keeps unfolding. Craig Timberg, National Technology Reporter for The Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Jaron Lanier, computer scientist, composer, visual artist, big web thinker, author of the new book, Who Owns the Future?, about the effects of big data and network technologies on our world. He's been talking and thinking for a long time about privacy, reality, virtual reality, the power dynamic between web users, governments, and big companies. Author of You Are Not a Gadget. His essay in this week's The Nation is headlined, The Meta Question, What is the NSA Doing with Your Meta Data? There's a link at our website. Jaron Lanier in Berkeley, California. Welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Always delighted to be here.
Are you as riveted by this NSA story as the rest of the country, the world, Jaron?
Well, yeah, I am, particularly because I'm currently doing my research in Microsoft's labs, and I can tell you it came as a total shock to all of us. So, you know, if there's anything going on, it's some kind of weird, stealthy thing. And so, yeah, absolutely, we're all terribly riveted.
How could you be working in the middle of Microsoft and have this come as a shock? I mean, Craig Timberg was just saying for the Washington Post that he and many others have assumed for a long time that some of this is something like this maybe has been going on. Did you not assume that somewhere in there the intelligence agencies were at work?
Well, you know, here I'll tell you what I assumed. What I assumed was that they would go to the FISA court with a specific starting point and a limited request, and then they'd follow up on that just like investigators always do. And furthermore, I assumed that just as there would be controls in place about what they're doing with data under court supervision, internally there'd be some sort of controls in place about what happens with their data. I mean, the one thing we know for sure, even if this guy, if this leaker is completely confabulating everything, the one thing he's not confabulating is that there were poor controls on information within the NSA. I mean, it's obviously a sloppy shop, and that's the first piece of information that's confirmed. Everything else is still fuzzy, but now we know that, and that's very disturbing.
So here we are with all of this exposed, and we frame this as a conversation about privacy and liberty. And I think this week a lot of people I mean, I'm jokingly here, Howard Fineman with the Huffington Post posted a tweet not long ago. He says, because of my daughter set me up for a Foursquare notice. I decided to sign up and download the app. Then he writes, do I have to notify the NSA or is that automatic? I mean, people yeah. are now wondering, you know, are the walls all down? Are we just naked? Is that what this new era means, Jaron?
Okay, so there's kind of what a lot of people are saying, which is absolutely true, is that there are two different questions to ask. One is what data is available to somebody, whether it's a commercial company or the government, and the other is what happens to the data. So there's kind of two kinds of prying eyes that have to be distinguished. One is human eyes and the other is sort of algorithmic eyes, you know, and it seems unlikely just because of the sheer quantity that specific humans are tracking specific other humans without some good reason. Although Snowden is saying that the system's leaking internally and that there are potential ways for people to track others. And normally, if the NSA said, no, that's impossible, I would give them credence because it sounds like it ought to be impossible. But on the other hand, he just leaked a bunch of stuff and that ought to be impossible, you know? Yeah. So maybe he does know some way. I mean, I don't know. So if it's true that individuals within the intelligence system can track individual Americans somehow, if there's some kind of flaw in the system that allows for that, then there's the potential for blackmail and political chicanery and all that stuff. But the other problem
Jared,
is...
Hold the thought there. We've got to take a short break.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about privacy and liberty in the age of the internet and big surveillance. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about privacy and liberty in the age of the internet and big surveillance with big thinker, web thinker, Jaron Lanier. He's author of the new book, Who Owns the Future? Also of You Are Not a Gadget. Jaron, let's just listen to a couple of people here. We'll start with the president. Here he was yesterday with his sort of calm down message on this. President Obama.
We've got congressional oversight and judicial oversight. And if people can't trust not only the executive branch, but also don't trust Congress and don't trust federal judges to make sure that we're abiding by the Constitution, due process, and rule of law, then we're going to have some problems here.
There's the president with his calm down message. Here's House Speaker John Boehner with his get fired up message, saying that Edward Snowden is a traitor.
He's a traitor. The president outlined last week that these are important national security programs to help keep Americans safe and give us tools to fight the terrorist threat that we face. The disclosure of this information puts Americans at risk. It shows our adversaries what our capabilities are, and it's a giant violation of the law.
And here's the leaker, traitor John Boehner says, one more time, Edward Snowden, saying this has all been sewn together around all of us. Here's Snowden from Hong Kong talking with The Guardian.
Even if you're not doing anything wrong, you're being watched and recorded. And the storage capability of these systems increases every year consistently by orders of magnitude to where it's getting to the point you don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call. And then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with.
Anything from any time, everywhere. Jaron, we want to dive deep into this with you, but we've got so many callers who want to come. Let me get Ben on here from Detroit, Michigan. Ben, you're on with Jaron Lanier. Thank you for calling. What's your question?
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you. This is a question, more of a comment, but it was something I haven't heard talked about before, or not too many people talk on the radio and news. It seems to be some confusion about how the NSA was able to get this information, and yet the corporations like Google, Facebook, Microsoft were able to deny it. Something I learned from, I watch a lot of and read a lot of tech information, and what they haven't talked about is that the way the NSA can do that is that they don't have to go to the actual servers of these organizations. A lot of people are using the word server. What they should be using is the word router. And what happens is the NSA can just go to the ISP of those corporations, and they can tap upstream, and they just tap basically all those corporations. They have to get their internet from somewhere, too. They tap those lines, and that's how they can get the information, and those corporations can remain completely uninformed about what the information is being done.
Well, maybe that's what it is. I mean, because they're denying, I don't know if that's plausible deniability or not, but on the other hand, the leaker says the government's gone to them, asked them, and tapped kind of straight in. Ben, I'm glad for that observation, that question. Jaron, we don't presume that you are privy to this, but you know the technology.
No, I'm not. And by the way, I have a particular arrangement with Microsoft where I totally speak for myself. So this is totally not a corporate, you know, comment at all. But yeah, I mean, technically, all kinds of things are feasible. I mean, basically, you can make digital systems do just about anything because you program them, you know. So, but whether, you know, whether it's feasible in a democracy, you know, under the rule of law is a completely different question. And I'd hope it isn't, you know. I mean, the truth is all of the comments we've gotten so far are very couched and very vague, so we don't know. I mean, we really have very little information. We know there's something that we ought to know, but we don't really know what it is.
I mean, the companies themselves are saying, let us be transparent about what you're asking us to do. And they're flat out denying, we do have that comment, at least in the Google's case, that they're participating in the way that the impression has been given. And here's the David Drummond again with Google, PBS NewsHour earlier this week, saying that explaining why Google wrote this letter to the Department of Justice, FBI, asking for permission to be more transparent about the government's requests for data. Here's Google's Drummond.
We sent that letter because there's been a serious misimpression that's been created in the wake of the stories that came out in the last few days, stories that we were as shocked by as everyone else. And the misimpression is that we're doing some kind of large scale or participating in a program that does large scale surveillance on our users. And that's just not the case.
Google says, nope, not us. Jaron Lanier, this can't all be true, can it? I mean,
well, you know, language is not precise, you know, so it might, I think the problem is that just speaking in English isn't a precise enough way to convey what's going on in a technical system. So it's entirely possible that everybody in the loop believes that they're speaking as honestly as they can. But to a reasonable person, it does sound like there's a contradiction here. That's precisely why this is so mysterious and so interesting. It's honestly baffling, and I hope that America won't let it just go by. I think it's really important to understand what's going on here.
Okay, we're not going to know all the details of that quite yet. Maybe never, but maybe we will. But we do know the technology. You've thought a lot about it, and the systems that are operating around us now, the networks that we are almost all caught up in now in our daily lives. So take us back, big picture here. What is the context in which this is going on? These revelations of the last week, you know, they come out and suddenly people say, well, geez, maybe everything. Maybe I'm just exposed, naked all the time. Are we? And what does it mean?
Well, boy, it's an epic story. All right, so one good starting place is about two decades ago, when computers got cheap enough that you could conceivably start to just gather the whole network into a big computer and process it. And that's when we saw the birth of the big internet companies. We saw the birth of all these business models where you gather personal information and try to target people with it. First of all, the intelligence community was all over Silicon Valley in those years. There was a kind of a co-evolution of intelligence technology and commercial technology. But the thing is that the initial promise turned out not to work. What the initial promise was that artificial intelligence would be able to automatically find the needle in the haystack. That was the metaphor of choice, that somehow you'd have these algorithms that could just find you the terrorist, find you the kingpin, that sort of thing. And in the abstract, there are a lot of demonstrations that it works, but in practice it's hard. One of the reasons is that it's really easy to create fake metadata. So criminals like the phishers and spammers of the world, the hucksters online, use fake data all the time.
They would disguise their profile, their whereabouts, their activity.
Yeah, so it becomes a cat and mouse game. And at the end of the day, this idea of finding the needle in the haystack automatically kind of faded away, and you don't even hear that metaphor anymore. And instead, what happened in Silicon Valley is a transformation to a really different way of using these types of computers, where what we do is we gather tons and tons of data, and then we use statistics to get an edge, a small edge, but a persistent one over time, in being able to put ads in front of people that are a little bit more effective than they might otherwise be. But it's a very imprecise, broad brush kind of a tool.
So there you're talking the world of commerce as goes to
right.
metadata. Okay.
And so in intelligence, what that might translate into is, well, this is what's interesting about it. It's like, how do they use that? How do they think about it? And that I don't have privy to. Now, so we have to distinguish two really different uses of this kind of data. One is when an investigator has some starting point. For instance, we know there was a Boston bombing. Can we go back in time and figure out who these people communicated with? Who were the bombers in touch with? So if there's a directed investigation with a person doing the interpreting, metadata is key. That's how analysis works, right? However, the idea of finding the bombers in advance, the idea that there's some magic button that can sort of analyze the world and understand people, has not proved to be fruitful. It just hasn't worked. And I suspect it won't work. But at least it's not working in our era.
So at an individual level, you're giving us some kind of comfort there about the possibility of tracking us individually or not.
Well, see, to me, it actually lowers my level of comfort, because I'm concerned that the legitimate uses of a sort of a total metadata system applied to the world population are just not real, you know, that there might. So if it's happening at all, what is its purpose? You know, what can they get out of it? And what I'm concerned about is that just as an investigator might be able to use metadata in a directed way in an investigation, so could a bad actor. And so what I'm asking is, if there's a Snowden, why can't there be a blackmailer? If there's a Snowden, why can't there be a government program that targets certain parts of the population who are in political disfavor, making it a little harder to get loans or something like that? I mean, when I think about, you know, that the metadata should be there available to specific investigations under a court authority makes sense. That seems legitimate. The notion of it just all being there all the time for some unstated purpose does not make sense. And that distinction is absolutely crucial. And we haven't seen enough transparency to understand where the line is being drawn right now.
Snowden as a blackmailer is easy to understand. I suppose he, instead of going public with The Guardian and The Washington Post, he could have somehow said to the U.S. government, I'm going to put this out there unless you pay me, or he could have sold it to somebody. The other side may not be as obvious. You're saying that through metadata, it might not be individuals who are tracked, but people who fit a certain profile, what, just given a little more friction in their lives, their digital lives or otherwise?
Sure. And so we've recently seen a scandal in which the IRS is accused of targeting certain kinds of groups with more scrutiny than other kinds of groups.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what's going on with that, and I'm not an expert in it. So I don't know if conservative groups have overall gotten a worse treatment than progressive groups, which have also sometimes been targeted in that mm-hmm. way. But the point is, it's, you know, you can target groups very subtly. You can say, well, you know what, we're not outright discriminating against you, but what we're doing is we're making it a little harder for you to deal with your taxes, or a little harder for you to get a loan, that sort of thing. And so those small slights compound over time, just the way compound interest works. They can turn into a big effect over the years. And what I'm concerned about is that a metadata system with its extremely broad brush could have an effect like that. For instance, let's suppose in the future there's a green government that hates the purple people or something like that. So okay. I want to try to get away from our red-blue divide.
Yes, fine.
And so they say, you know, these purple people statistically are sometimes correlated with people who talk to terrorists. So when somebody from that population wants a loan, they should just deserve a little extra scrutiny. And the FISA court or whatever it is in this mm-hmm. hypothetical country says, yeah, you know, that seems reasonable.
Which puts a little headwind in there for those people.
It's just a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, it's applied consistently over time. And so then what happens is, 10 years later, everybody who's in that camp is just a little less well off and a little less influential. And the thing is, that's kind of what we do with our commercial services in Silicon Valley, you know, if one was going to speak broadly.
Social engineering, you say. Facebook is, in a way, you write for The Nation, done some social engineering on a whole generation's understanding of privacy itself.
Right, right. So, you know, the problem here, the way I put it in the article, is it's a contest between invisibles. You have this hypothetical ability to thwart terrorist plots, which isn't really proven, and that's posed against this sort of undefinable thing called privacy. So you have these two sort of very vague, invisible things in conflict with each other. And that's very frustrating and very difficult to talk about. So I propose that what we should talk about instead of privacy is equity between normal people and people who have the biggest computers, whether they're in government or industry, because that's the core issue here.
That seems like pretty tough equity to sustain. If they've got the big, big, big computers, they've got, as you put it, an edge over time. Jaron's with us from Berkeley. Jaron, lots of callers here. Let me bring on Claire from Nashville, Tennessee. Claire, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking my call today. Mm-hmm. I agree with your guest on many of the points that he says. However, all of us are involved with metadata in our lives every day. When you go to the grocery store, they print out coupons based on your past history of items that you have purchased
sure.
in the past.
Yep.
We have the expectation that our profile that what you use to arrange for business travel already knows which vegan lunch that you want while you're on the airplane mm-hmm. and what kind of pillows you want when you go to your hotel room. Mm-hmm. So we rely on the applications of metadata. My background is in healthcare,
mm-hmm.
and I can tell you that just this year, a huge national award has been awarded to the Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital System because they have put medical records from literally millions of people on a server so that when their doctors walk around with their iPads and say, oh, well, you're a diabetic and you mm-hmm. drink, a protein supplement mm-hmm. every day, mm-hmm. and that has helped control your blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So we applaud this. I'm a native of Boston, Massachusetts, and so I was one of the Americans who was glued to the TV for the 72 hours, and we applauded our national security and police forces
when they went after the Marathon
their
bombers.
Efficiency in that event.
Yeah.
So it's disingenuous of us to say that we're not aware of the reality of metadata in our lives.
Claire, our time is short before the break. Let me pick it up right there, if I may, and bring it to you, Jaron. I mean, Claire says, you know, can we say, on the one hand, profile me and serve me. On the other hand, say, don't spy on me. Can we do that?
Yeah, it's really tough. And in fact, I agree with the caller completely that there are tremendous benefits to metadata, and many of us have good reason to share it. So this brings up the question, what do you do? And the current idea is that we have lawyers and judges try to foresee what might happen with metadata and regulate what happens with it. I've been promoting and exploring an alternative, which is to make data cost money so that the government can make moderate use of it, but not arbitrarily infinite use of it, which is, I think, the balance we need to find.
Make it cost money. In other words, if you want to use my data, pay me. So it would put some brake
yeah.
on it.
Yeah, I know it sounds like a sort of a radical idea, but the problem is I don't think we can be articulate enough and foresightful enough to write laws or set policies that anticipate what programmers can come up with. But if data is free, it sort of suggests infinite spying and infinite manipulation. So the way to really deal with a broad problem like that is with a broad brush solution of making data cost money. So it might sound odd, but I think it's ultimately the solution we have to come to.
Of course, we'll talk about it, but if it's out there, how do you make somebody pay for it? Why don't they just grab it? Jaron Lanier, stand by. We'll look at that and more. Jaron Lanier joins us from Berkeley, California. Big thinker on all things digital and beyond. His piece in The Nation is headlined, The Meta Question. What is the NSA doing with your meta data? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about privacy and liberty in the age of the internet and big surveillance with big thinker, web thinker, Jaron Lanier. He's author of Who Owns the Future? Lots of people thinking about this. Here's Dick Durbin, Senate Appropriations Committee hearing yesterday, the Democratic senator from Illinois, said it defies logic that it would make sense to scoop up all this information.
It certainly defies logic that you need to collect all of the telephone calls made in the 312 area code on the chance that one of those persons might be on the other end of the phone.
Maybe it defies logic, but if you've got the capacity, why not? We've got huge data centers now. Here's Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, talking with CNN, wondering where it all goes.
If we put a microchip in every baby born, we could follow everybody better. Or if we said, well, crime is committed by people who live in apartments, why don't we put cameras in everyone's apartments? You could go for zero tolerance of any kind of crime, but you'd be giving up your freedom. Our founding fathers said warrants have to be specific to the person in place. Generalized warrants, I think, are unconstitutional.
Here's the leaker one more time, Edward Snowden, saying from what he saw inside, if you don't restrict this firmly with policy, it will spread.
It's only going to get worse until eventually there will be a time where policies will change, because the only thing that restricts the activities of the surveillance state are policy.
Only policy will do it. Jaron Lanier in Berkeley, California is here. You want to put a price on data, on our data. What would that do? Why wouldn't the government just step right around it, Jaron?
Well, you know, we have these armies of people called accountants and lawyers who annoy us terribly,
yep.
And yet they serve a function. So what would happen, I think, in a regime where you're paid when your information is used, is that the government would have to get a warrant and be very specific. And if it took a broad brush approach to gathering data, it would have to raise taxes and would have to argue that the expense was worthwhile, and it probably would fail at that. And if it wanted to contravene that, it would get sued. When there's accounting, when there's real money at stake, actually you have it doesn't replace policy, but it creates an adjunct to it that might make policy at least conceivable. If information is free, I don't think it's humanly possible to write these policies in advance. That's the problem.
Maybe, though the NSA seems at no shortage of money. They got the Fed to print the money if they want to pay to get your data. We quoted George Orwell at the top here before you came on. And let me just read this again. This is from 1984. Maureen Dowd quoted it over the weekend. But Orwell saying there was describing what the circumstance that developed in that famous dystopian novel of oppression. There was, of course, no way of knowing whether you were being watched at any given moment, how often or on what system the thought police plugged in on any individual wire was guesswork. It was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time. But at any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. Is that inevitable? Is that where we are, Jaron?
Well, I mean, the task before us is to not go there. It's a conceivable future. It's one that it sometimes seems we're on the road to entering.
Edward Snowden kind of says we're there.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, if you want to have the attitude that it's hopeless and we have no choice to dive into it, I can't. I mean, I, what can I tell you? But I think that the right question to ask is how can we avoid it? And so certainly we need to use every tool at our disposal. And, our democratic system seems to currently have failed to make this aspect of what we're doing transparent. And that's terrifying. I'm only proposing that we need to bring in our commercial system as well. We need to use everything.
A generation has been taught by Facebook that privacy may not be so important. You're a big thinker here. Is privacy fundamental?
You keep on saying that.
Well, we've got to tag you somehow. Musician doesn't do it in this context.
Facebook is a great example of social engineering. Facebook somehow convinced the whole world of young people in just a few years to have a different attitude about privacy. And the problem with that is that you can abstract privacy and say it's just one little thing and it has nothing to do with your commercial prospects and your career and it has nothing to do with your political standing. But the problem is that it's not a fair kind of loss of privacy because you don't have the giant computer to scrutinize the other people who are scrutinizing you. So the people with the giant computers can analyze more of your data than you can of theirs. So a loss of privacy isn't this generally open and fair thing that it seems to be at first. And that's the problem with it. There really isn't equity. And so, you know, we can get around that someday by paying people for their data. Maybe another solution is that everybody's issued a supercomputer someday when they get cheap enough. There might be various ways to get around this, but what the Facebook generation has been taught is a lie, which is that there's some kind of openness and fairness about sharing information. And the reason it's a lie is that people with the biggest computers can just do so much more that it's unfair.
So You've got a generation here that may not care as much about privacy. Can you give up your privacy and have liberty, in your view?
Well, it's tricky because if you give up your privacy in the way that this generation is doing it, first of all, to my view, and my view is controversial, to be clear, it's also having a detrimental effect on their commercial prospects. So they say, I'll give away my data for free, but we're entering more and more of an information economy. And so what they're really saying is, I'll work for free. If we enter a world in which there are 3D printers instead of factories, there won't be jobs designing for 3D printers because you share those for free because sharing is good. And so we're entering into this world of reduced financial expectations that's actually the flip side of the reduction of privacy. And that does have an effect on liberty. Once again, it's a slow creeping kind of an effect. But, you know, the more wealth and influence is concentrated in a tiny minority, the more democracy is stressed. And, you know, this is a problem in our politics already. And the way we're doing things with open information benefiting the people with the biggest computers is only furthering this idea of concentration of wealth and influence. And so, I do think that what the Facebook generation's been taught is to their detriment in the long term.
And, of course, I guess it's the government that has the biggest computers of all. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts is calling. Hi, Peter. You're on the air with Jaron Lanier.
Yes, hello. The one thing, and you've just touched on it, and the woman who called before comes from the healthcare area. I come mm-hmm. from history and policy, and I remember vividly the passage of the Patriot Act and the tremendous cheering from both parties about it, that it was going to be the lifesaver, you know, of everything, famous last words. But that really throws open the doors, doesn't it? Because then, you can spy in secrecy, you know, on anybody that you suspect or whatever. And if your leaders don't read the bloody thing, and I gathered most of them really didn't read it very carefully, you're really asking for the devil. You're throwing open a Pandora's box, and the machines and the data will be everywhere. And you might have decent people who might be well-intentioned, but eventually you're going to get a devil who will misuse this information that might be, you know, decades down the line. And the thing I'm most frustrated by is that we've been so driven by a sense of progress that we just paid no real heed to the next corner, which could be full of brambles. And we've just consciously, through Facebook, as you point out, we've just been giving our lives away, our privacy, everything else.
Peter, I appreciate your call. Jaron Lanier, you write kind of along these lines about the vanities of present-day technophile triumphalism, as though it's all progress. There's progress in there, but what about Peter's concerns about the dark side?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's really touched on exactly the right point. I mean, I've had occasion to meet various folks that are in the intelligence services these days because, you know, we're in the same technical field. And so I can say that the ones I've met are good people. You know, I actually would trust the ones that I've met. And likewise, in Silicon Valley, I think we have a remarkably pleasant and good-natured elite, remarkably even by historical standards. So we're lucky, but the problem is if we set up systems that are inherited by people who aren't so great, it really doesn't matter that the earlier people were nice, you know. And so we have to assume the worst from people when we design our systems. And even if you think Snowden is a villain, you have to appreciate that he brings to light that our current systems don't foresee villains adequately. And I'm not sure if he is. I'm still on the fence about him right now. But we're definitely not being paranoid enough about ourselves, which is, you know, which is the most important thing. You know, we're much more paranoid about shadowy dangers that are less clear. But our own danger to ourselves is the most clear one that we have to be the most attentive to.
Peter points back to the Patriot Act as sort of, you know, the devil's boulevard to mischief here. Do you look at law or economics or both as or one or the other as the bigger lever to put some brake on this?
Oh, man. I think we need to use everything. I mean, I think this is absolutely core to having a decent democracy, and we can't rule out anything. I think we have to push on law, we have to push on societal standards and education, and we have to bring commerce into the picture. We need it all.
Let's go to Chloe in Newington, Connecticut. Hi, Chloe, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. I have a few quick things. First of all, I wanted to thank you for quoting 1984. I feel as though there's just a list a mile long of literature and movies that all point to the same sort of dystopian society where we're all being controlled by the government or corporations or whatever it may be, but it seems like we're still headed there a million miles an hour. Second of all, I wanted to bring a quote from Benjamin Franklin to the table. I believe Ron Paul actually used this quote recently in regard to this same issue. And the quote is that those who would sacrifice a little freedom for a little security deserve neither and will lose both. And lastly, I just wanted to point out that if we were to compare the world population to the world number of terrorists, obviously, it's an incredibly small fraction of the population. And if an incredibly small fraction of the population can end up making it that the rest of us lose our rights, I kind of feel like they've won. I mean, we need to be able to keep our rights and still keep ourselves safe.
Yeah, no question. That's the goal. And we're looking with Jaron at what's endemic to this new age of technology we're in and what's not, what we can pull off here. I guess that remains the question, Jaron. If liberty in the old style, in the old sense, with its notion of privacy wrapped around it, is sustainable in the face of this technology.
Right. Well, you know, liberty is an interesting it's another one of these words like privacy that's actually hard to define, mm-hmm. and particularly as technology changes. And I'm a little concerned that we use these words without understanding how little we know about them right now.
But if we jettison them, what have we got?
Well, no, but I think we can find some ideas that are more concrete. And I think, you know, so one idea is a sense of equity, that in individual power, individual self-determination can't be overwhelmed by a remote entity like the government. I think that's a fairly concrete statement. Mm-hmm. And right now, because of computation, if everybody's sharing information freely, whoever has the giant computer does have such an edge over an ordinary person who doesn't have the giant computer that there is that sense of being overwhelmed. And so restoring some kind of an equity there ought to be possible by changing the architecture of how we do things. Making information cost money seems to me to be the simplest approach, but there are other ideas that could work too. So I think a concept of computational equity is at least concrete, and I think we can gradually start to talk about that. I think liberty, you know, it's a funny thing. A lot of people in technology have such a mechanical worldview at this point. They think of people as computers and the giant net as making a giant computer out of the people, and there's this sort of materialist ethic that's become so powerful that in a way they don't really believe in free will anymore. And there's a whole kind of philosophy in which the idea of liberty doesn't quite make sense in the way it might to other people. And I'm that's another level at which we have to have a conversation. There has to be technology. People have to treat humans as being sort of mystical, special creatures, you know, and we're not doing enough of that.
That shift, I think, is what I'm smelling in somewhere running around your observations. I'm glad you put it just that way. You look out on this new world and your mind goes back to the Wild West sometimes when people were running out and grabbing whatever they could get, and the six gun was in a way an equalizer. Is computational equity the new, you know, the new six gun? Most of us aren't going to have supercomputers, but you're saying change your sense of the whole. In the Wild West, you could grab whatever was available until the law came and you couldn't. Maybe that's where your equity comes in.
Well, you know, what I'm saying actually is that the six gun was sort of a fake equalizer. Mm. It probably helped sort of macho guys who were good with guns more than other people. So in a sense, it spread unfairness, but it never gave you ownership of the railroad, which was where the real power was. So, you know, I'm in a sense trying to mock the sort of Wild West metaphor system that we use in technology. I note that Snowden has an Electronic Frontier Foundation sticker on his laptop, and great organization, love the EFF, but the frontier idea that there's something that we want to recapture from the Wild West is probably not helpful. And I I think that sometimes the strongest advocates of liberty online fall into traps of their own making, where they want to create a sort of an anarchic system that might benefit techie people or people who are very good with computers, who have very good computers, but might not help ordinary people that much. So in a sense, I was trying to bring that to light.
Do you think we have more to learn on the details? I mean, we clearly do. Will we learn more about exactly what's going on here? Do you expect the lid to come down?
Boy, I hope we do, and I hope we don't lose track of this, because this is important stuff. This is important stuff in the long term of where America is going in this century, and the world for that matter. And I hope we can figure out what the hell happened here. What did this guy actually know? I mean, I have to tell you, the very first words out of his mouth impressed me, and I thought, wow, this guy seems more mature and articulate than Manning did, the previous leaker.
Bradley Manning,
Bradley Manning, right. Mm-hmm. And he seems... you know, this might be, in a way, the leaker we've been waiting for. But ever since then, he seems to be kind of getting a little paranoid and a little maybe disconnected from reality. And I'm not sure where he's going. I'm now not sure what kind of figure we're dealing with.
Hard to be sort of on the run in Hong Kong with the NSA on your tail and not be a little paranoid. Is that really
But he chose it. I mean, he chose to put himself in that position.
He did, and he opened up a huge conversation. We're grateful to you, Jaron, for helping us push it just a little further here today. Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future? His piece in The Nation is The Meta Question. What is the NSA doing with your meta data? Joining us from Berkeley, California today. Jaron, it's always good to talk with you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. Facebook, too, or me on Twitter, Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.